Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Pei Gimel Amud Bet by the two dots. We are discussing in the Mishnah that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says that when the individual declares that he is forfeiting all his rights in the Nifsei Malog, that includes his right to veto a sale by his wife, that includes the right to eat the peirot, the output from that property, and the final right, which is his right to inherit the property if she predeceases him. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says all of those are true except with regards to the Yerusha. The problem with the Yerusha is that that is a Torah mandated Yerusha according to Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Rashi on the Mishnah explains the derivation of that din d'oraita, which is learned in the Gemara in Bava Batra, that a husband, mi d'oraita, according to that, is entitled to inherit his wife if she predeceases him. If that's the case, if someone puts a condition or forfeits their right to that Yerusha, that's what we call matneh davar shekatuv b'Torah. Someone is then stipulating that a law of the Torah will not take effect, and that they're not allowed to do. Now the Gemara discusses that. Amar Rav, halacha k'Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. The halacha is like Rabban Shimon Gamliel in our Mishnah, velo mitameh, but not for the reason that he gives. So now the Gemara wants to understand that in more detail. My halacha k'Rabban Shimon Gamliel velo mitameh. What does that mean? Ilema, if you want to suggest halacha k'Rabban Shimon Gamliel damar imeta yirashena, that the halacha is in accordance with what Shimon Gamliel says, which is that if she predeceases him, he will inherit her despite the fact that he declared or relinquished his rights to that. Velav mitameh, but not for his reasoning. Dilu Rabban Shimon Gamliel Savar Matnea Mashikatuv B'Torah, someone who creates a condition that will upend a law of the Torah, Tana'o Batel, that condition is considered to be irrelevant. Rav Savar, on the other hand, Rav believes Tana'o Kayam, that that condition will be upheld and it can go against the Torah. But then why over here does it not work? Why is the halacha like Rabban Shimon Gamliel? Kasavar Yushat Habal Dirabanan. That's because Rav believes that the Yusha of the husband is not Midoraita, but rather only rabbinic in nature. And the Limudim that we have are simply an Asmachta. V'chachamim asu yichizuk l'divrihem yoter mishel Torah. And the rabbis reinforced this Takanat Chachamim to have more power than even a Torah law. With regards to a Torah law, we would say that one can't make such a condition with regards to monetary matters. On the other hand, over here, where it's only a din derabanan, in order to reinforce the din derabanan, they give it more power, more strength than a regular din d'oraita, and therefore they do not allow the condition to override what would otherwise be the din derabanan of the Rishat Habal if the wife predeceases him. So Rav says Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel is correct in his assessment of the situation that he still will inherit the woman, but not for that reason, not because it's min haTorah, rather because it's rabbinic, and in being rabbinic, the Chachamim established that that would have superpowers. V'sova Rav t'na'o kayam. Does Rav really believe that a condition that violates a din d'oraita will be upheld? V'ayitmar, don't we have a machloku between Rav and Shmuel with regards to exactly this matter? Ha'omer l'chavero, person who says to his friend, Almanat shein l'cha alai ona'a, he transacts with an individual, sells him an object, and says it will not be subject to the rules of Torah with price gouging. So even if I overcharge you by a significant amount, it won't be relevant over here. You are accepting the price, despite the fact that that price may be a violation of a din Torah of overcharging. Rav Amar, Yeshalo Alav Ona'a. Rav says, no, the transaction goes through, and the party can make a claim here and say that he sold it to me and overcharged me, and he can get a refund of that amount. Shmuel Amar, Ein lo alav ona'a. Shmuel says, this is a monetary matter, and in monetary matters, people can come to any agreement between them. Over here, if the two parties agreed that they would not be subject to the rule of ona'a min haTorah, that is fine. Now, as Tosafot points out, that Rav can even be according to Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda believes that in general, you can make conditions or tna'im when it comes to monetary matters, despite the fact that it then obviates the need for a din Torah, that is permissible. Rav says, despite that fact, over here, Rabbi Yehuda would agree. And that is because in normal cases where you have an agreement between the parties, machla, the individual forgives or waives their right to such monetary compensation because they know what they're entitled to, and then they forgive it. Over here, with regards to the ona'ah, the individual doesn't know what the overcharging is or what the misrepresentation is in order to forgive for it. And therefore, even according to Rabbi Yehuda, who says, davar shebemano tano kayam, over here, Rabbi Yehuda would agree to me, Rab says, that mi yoda demachil, he doesn't know what the overcharging is that he can forgive it. And over here too, in our case of the Yerusha, you can't say that the husband knows about it and he's forgiving because he doesn't even know if he's going to inherit it. There's a certain amount of underlying uncertainty as to whether he's even going to get this property at all. So you can't say that he knows for certainty and he waived his right and he forgave it. And therefore Rav will say over here as well that Rabbi Yehuda would agree that in these cases, these are exceptions to the rule where the individual can't forgive or override the Din Torah because they don't know what they're forgiving. They don't know to forgive in these instances, as opposed to cases where it's obvious what the agreement between the parties is and they know exactly what they're forfeiting in terms of rights. Over there, they may be able to make a tenai according to Rabbi Yehuda. Shmuel, on the other hand, says, there's no ona'ah over here. It's agreement between the parties and can say, like Rabbi Yehuda, that this is a monetary matter and therefore we're allowed to make conditions in the monetary matter. There are others that view the issue here in terms of ona'ah as an issue of monetary matter as well as isur. The overcharging is a monetary matter. The violation of the isur ona'ah is an isur min haTorah. So even if you can get over the monetary issues, you may not be able to overcome the aspect of isur. And maybe that's why Rav says over here that the ona'ah is not waived. In terms of the monetary side of it, you're right, it could be waived. But since you violated the Isur of Ona'ah, that you can't waive. And since you can't waive that, that reopens the monetary issue because of the violation of the Isur if we allow you to not return the Ona'ah or for the individual not to make a claim of Ona'ah. So if that's the case, then Rav certainly can't say that when it comes to Oraita, Atnai is Kayam. We say over here that here when he makes a tenai against the din of ona'ah, it's not kayam. Ela halacha ki rabban shem gamliel damar amatneh masha ketuv b'Torah to know batel. But what you have to say is halacha is like rabban shem gamliel that any person makes a condition against the Torah, the condition is considered to be null and void. Vilav mi ta'amei, but not for his reasoning. Vila rabban shem gamliel savar meita yirashena, because rabban shem gamliel believes that if she predeceases him, he will inherit her. Virav Savar Meita Lo Yirashena. On the other hand, Rav believes that when she predeceases him, he will not inherit her. So, as Rashi points out over here, the reason that is because he believes that Yerushata Baal's Dirabanan. Rav believes that the inheritance of the husband is only a rabbinic edict, and therefore, if he relinquished that right, then that's his choice. And the Chachamim did not reinforce their din greater than the Torah level. So you're right, if it was a Torah level law, in Ochanami we would say, t'nau batel, that the condition is null and void. But over here we're dealing with the rabbinic issue, and that's why the condition is upheld. So Gemara says, well, if that's what you term what Rav is saying about Rabban Shimon Gamliel, that is, hai mitamei velo geochatei, who? That is saying that his reason is right, but his conclusion in Halacha is wrong. Hamidameh means that Rav agrees that if it wasn't Doraita law, that the Tanai, the condition would be null and void. And therefore he agrees with Rabban Shmuel's position in that matter. On the other hand, he does not agree with the halachic outcome here. He thinks that Rabban Shmuel believes that the husband will inherit, and Rav believes that the husband will not inherit. So it's actually the opposite. He agrees with his position, but he disagrees that it's relevant over here, and therefore he comes to a different halachic conclusion. So if that's the case, it's hamitamei v'lo kehilchatei, who? Then that's the case where he agrees with the reasoning, but not with the halachic outcome. Ela halacha ki Rabban Shimon Gamliel damar im meita yirashena. The halacha is like Rabban Shimon Gamliel that says that if she predeceases him, he will inherit her. Bilav mitamei, but not for his reason. Deil Rabban Shimon Gamliel savar bidoraita tenau batel. That if you try to put together a condition in a transaction that would abrogate a Torah law, to know batel, the Tanai is invalid. Habid Rabbanan. On the other hand, if you did this at the rabbinic level, to know kayam, then that condition would be upheld, and it would not be a problem to override a din derabanan. On the other hand, Virav Savar, Afilu Bid Rabbanan, to know batel. Even at the rabbinic level, his condition is considered to be invalid. So now, Gemara is suggesting over here that Rav basically fully agrees with Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. He agrees with Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel that the halacha is meita yirashena. If she predeceases him, he will inherit her. He also agrees with Rabban Shimon Gamliel that when it comes to dinim d'oraita, the t'nai would be invalid if you tried to establish a t'nai against that which is written in the Torah. The only difference between them is that in the level d'rabanan, Rabban Shimon Gamliel believes they would be fine to make such a condition that would override a din d'rabanan. On the other hand, Rab believes that is not the case. As Rashi points out over here, that any t'nai that goes up against a rabbinic edict, that would not be invalid according to Rav. And that means that Rav and our Mishnah would think, number one, you cannot make a t'nai against the husband inheriting the property, and you also cannot make a condition that he won't get peirot. Peirot are also a din d'rabanan. And therefore, in this instance, Rav would say that is also invalid if you make a t'nai or condition that he will not partake in the peirot. Tosafot disagrees with Rashi and says that even Rav would agree that the peirot would go through. That if the husband says, I have no rights to the peirot, that would be binding on him, even though in general he would say conditions can override a din d'rabanan. But as Tosafot points out, that's only true when we're talking about dinei d'rabanan that are shchiach, dinei d'rabanan that are common. Things that are less common, over there, we do not say that the t'nai is invalid. There we say that the t'nai is upheld, despite the fact that it's overriding a din d'rabanan. The other way you could formulate it, somewhere along the lines of the Tosafot, is that when it comes to Yerusha, which is a d'rabanan paralleled after a d'oraita, over there, Rav believes that the t'nai is invalid when you try to override it. On the other hand, when you're dealing with a din d'rabanan peirot, which is a totally new din, has no precedence or paradigm within the dinei d'oraita, over there, we would not say that the t'nai, the condition, is invalid. So the Gemara asks once again, that does not fit what we said at the beginning of this Gemara. Hai kitame ukihilchateidhu. That is the same reason, the same halakhic outcome, v'rav mosifu. And all that Rav is doing is adding on an additional restriction. How can you say that Rav's statement in the beginning was the halacha is like Rabban Shimon Gamliel, but la mitame, not for his reason. Over here, the halacha is like Rabban Shimon Gamliel, and his reasoning is correct. And then Rav adds on top of that, that even though the Rushet Abal was only mitzvah Rabbanan, and therefore you're wrong about that point, Rabban Shimon Gamliel, nevertheless, the halacha outcome is the same because Rav believes that tonight is batel, whether you're going up against a din d'oraita or a din d'rabanan. So once again, this explanation doesn't fit the wording that we saw at the beginning of the sugya. Ella, this is the proper explanation. Halacha k'Rabban Shimon Gamliel, damar imeita yirashena. The halachic principle that Rabban Shimon Gamliel set up is correct, which is, if the wife predeceases the husband, then the husband is entitled to the property. B'lav mitamei, but not for the same reason as Rabban Shimon Gamliel. Dealer Rabban Shimon Gamliel savar yirushata ba'al d'oraita. Rabban Shimon Gamliel believes that the inheritance of the husband is a din min ha-Torah. And that's why the condition to relinquish that right is invalid over here, because he's trying to create a condition against that which is written in the Torah. V'rav savar yushata bal dirabanan. On the other hand, Rav believes that the inheritance is only a din dirabonon. V'chachamim asu chizuk l'divrihem keshel Torah. And the Chachamim strengthened the din here, the din d'rabanan, to the point where it was as strong as the din Torah. And since it's as strong as the din Torah, therefore the t'nai would be invalid in this case. So now we have the halachic principle that Rabban Shimon establishes, which is that the husband will inherit over here, despite the fact that he relinquished such a right, that both Rabban Shimon and Rav would agree. That is the case. What's the reason for that? According to Rabban Shimon Gamliel, it's because Yerushat Abal d'oraita, and you can't create a condition against the din d'oraita. And the reasoning behind Rav is that it's a rabbinic law, and the rabbinic law over here, they established to be just like the Torah law. And as such, the t'nai is invalid. Now the Gemara comes back and starts challenging this understanding, because is that really the position of Rav? Rav savar Yerushat Abal d'rabanan? Does Rav really believe that the inheritance of the husband is only a rabbinic din? Vatanan? Don't we have a Mishnah in Bechorot? Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha Omer, Hayoreshet Ishto. Person who inherits his wife, Yachzir libnei mishpacha, Minachelahem min hadamim. He will return it to the family, and he has to discount them the price that he gives it back to them as. Vahabinamba. And we ask Micah Savar, and then I want to know, what is he thinking? How do we explain this position? Now, as both Rashi and Tosafot point out over here, this is talking about at the Yovel. At the Yovel, the husband will be compelled to return the property to the family. And again, he won't get full compensation for that. He'll get a small amount of remuneration for returning them this property. And the Gemara wants to know, Micah Savar, what's going on in this Mishnah? If he believes Yerushata Baal Doraita, the inheritance of the husband is a Din Doraita, Amayechzir, then why is he compelled to return the property? Yovel only affects transactions. If someone purchased a property, when you come to the Yovel, you have to return the property to the original owner. On the other hand, when you're talking about Yerusha, Yerusha is not subject to Yovel. The Yovel does not reverse inheritance. Once someone's inherited the property, it becomes their property, and Yovel is no longer relevant. V'derabanan, if you believe that Yerushata Baal is only a din derabanan, then it would be subject to Yovel, because the husband, in a sense, is like a acquirer of the property. Since he's an acquirer of the property, when the Yovel comes, he has to return it to the original owners, which over here would be the family of the woman. So damim ma'vitayu, then why do they have to compensate him at all? They're entitled to the property because of the din of Yovel. Why should they have to compensate him? V'amarav. So Rav came to explain this scenario and says, La'olam kasavar, he believes, Yerushata Baal Doraita, the inheritance of the husband is a Torah din. So then why does Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka in that case say that first of all he has to give it back at the Yovel? And number two is, why does he get compensation for it? Ukagon, Sharishato Ishto Beit HaKavarot. It was a scenario in which his wife bequeathed to him a piece of property that held the family burial plot in it. Mishom Pagam Mishpacha. And over here, the Rabbanon interceded on behalf of the wife's family to get them back their personal, sentimental burial plot that belongs to their family. Because of the Pagam Mishpacha, as Rashi notes over here, they will then have to be buried in other lots that don't belong to them. And other people who are not a part of their family will be buried in their lot. And that is a Pagam Mishpacha. That is something that reflects poorly on their family. And therefore, the Chachamim empowered them to get the property back. But they will have to make remuneration over here because they're not really entitled to the property at the time of the Yovel. And that's why Amor Rabbanon Lishkol Demei V'lahader, let him be compensated for it, and he'll return the property. So then, Uzumai Yinachelehem Min Adamim. What does it mean that he has to give them a discount? Why should he have to give them a discount at all? He should have to give them back the property and get fully compensated for it. It says, no, that discount is to make kever ishto, his requirement to bury his wife. He has the obligation to compensate, to pay for the burial of his wife. And therefore, when he used this burial plot for his wife, that was something that should have come out of his pocket, not out of the family's pocket. So he will, in a sense, compensate them for the burial of his wife by deducting that amount from the sale price. So when he returns the property to them, they'll pay him the money minus what it would have cost him to bury his wife over there. And that way, they are paying for the property in return. He is paying for his wife's burial. He was the real inheritor of the property, so technically Yovel would not affect. But the Chachamim established that Yovel will affect over here in order to prevent the Pagam Mishpacha. But because of that, the family has to compensate him for that. Tosafot does ask a basic question over here. Then why wait to the Yovel? Why can't we reverse the transaction immediately? Why is the Yovel relevant at all in this situation? So Tosafot suggests that maybe the Yovel is relevant because until the Yovel, nobody knows who the property really belongs to or where it's going. But once the Yovel comes around and all the property in hell has been redistributed to its original owners, and we see here, it still hasn't gone back to that family. That's when it becomes an issue of Pagam Mishpacha. And that's why the Chachamim established at the Yovel that they will be able to take that property back and compensate him for it. You could also argue that the Chachamim did not want to create a totally new din, but rather pattern it after something that already existed. And since already in the Yovel, there is movement of property back to original owners. So over here, they did the same thing and they moved the burial plot back to the original owner. Kedetanya. As we have in a braita, a mocher kivro, b'derech kivro, mamado mekom es bedo, a person sells out their personal burial plot within their family tract. And the way to that plot, Mamado, the places that they do the Mamadot that are associated with the burial, Makom Hasbedo, in the place that they have the eulogies, the Bayim B'nei Mishpacha, the family can come, V'kovrim oto bal korcho. They can bury the individual there, despite the objections of the purchaser of the property, Mishum B'gam Mishpacha, because of the way that it reflects negatively on their family if they don't bury him over there. And again, as Rashi notes, then they'll have to bury themselves in other places, and other people will be buried in their plots, and that's not what they want. That is unbecoming for their family. So I says, Rav, the Tamei Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha Kamar. There's no stira here. Rav over there is just explaining what the position of Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha is. And explaining his position, he says that Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha believes that Yushat HaBaal is Deoraita, that the inheritance of a husband is a din min haTorah. Velelo svirle, but Rav himself does not believe that. Rav himself believes that Yushat HaBaal is only derabanan. And therefore, Rav's explanation of Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha is not a stira to his psak halacha over here with regards to Rabban Shimon Gamaliel, the lav mitame, that the halacha is that the husband does inherit over here, but not for his reasoning, because over here, Rav believes that the inheritance of the husband is only midrabanan. Why did they undermine the tnai? It's because asuch hezuk de devrayam kishel Torah. They made their law like a Torah law, and therefore you cannot make a condition to undermine it, but it's still only a rabbinic law. And in the case by the burial plot, there he was explaining Rabbi Yochanan ben Brocha, but that was not his personal position. Now the lokeach, the purchaser in this case, will have to return the property immediately as opposed to the ovel, because by the case of the husband, he did nothing wrong. It was just the property came to an inheritance. Therefore, we wait until the ovel in order to make that exchange. Here by the purchaser, where he purchased the property and he knows he shouldn't have done that, or he shouldn't have done that, they will compel him to return or reverse the transaction immediately and allow the family to bury this individual in that plot. Okay, next Mishnah. Mi shemet v'niach isha ubalchov v'yorshim. Person who passed away and he left behind a wife who has a claim against the estate for tuba. Balchov, creditors that have a claim against the estate to get repaid for their loans. V'yorshim, and the inheritors of the property, otherwise known as yitomim, the orphans that left behind, that have entitlement to the property. Fayalo pikadon o milve biadachirim. And he has either a deposit of some sort or a loan out to other parties. Rabbi Tarfon Omer, you not know the koshos shebehen. That property is not subject to the regular rules of inheritance in this case. And therefore we will take that property and give it to the weakest amongst them. So first of all, in general, when it comes to inheritance, the yitomim would be the automatic recipients of any inheritance over here. And anybody who wanted to again make a claim against the estate would have to deal with the estate and the yitomim themselves. On the other hand over here, since this money is not kept directly in the estate, it's in the hands of a third party, either because that third party is watching this deposit or because the money was lent to this third party. When that money is being repaid or that pikadon is returned, at that point in time, there's a window in which other parties could exercise their rights before it automatically ends up in the hands of the yitomim, in the hands of those that are the yorshim here. As Rashi points out over here, when it comes to non-real property, there is no encumbrance of creditors on that property when it comes to yitomim, not to a balchov, not to a ktubah. Over here, la bishutayu manchev, this property, these outstanding loans, or this outstanding deposit that he has with someone else, are not under the control of the yitomim. And that gives us this unique opportunity to give the money to someone else. So now we give it the koshel shebehen, to the weakest amongst them. And the Gemara will discuss what exactly that means. Rabbi Kiva Omer, ein merachmin bedin. When it comes to halacha, we don't invoke principles of rachamim, of mercy over here. It either belongs to one of the parties, or it doesn't belong to the party. We don't say we give it to the weakest of the parties. Ela, yinatnu liyorshin. They'll be given to the inheritors. Shukulan tzrichim shvua. Because any other party that has a claim against the estate requires a shvua. Ve'en yorshin tzrichim shvua. On the other hand, the Yoshim don't require a Shvua in order to collect the property. They are the natural standing inheritors of the property. They are the default inheritors of anything that's here. Therefore, according to Rabbi Akiva, the question is, what is the central theme of Rabbi Akiva's position? Is it that Tfisa does not work, which is that if someone comes and grabs something when they have entitlement, but they may not have been the first individual in line to take it, that does not work? We'll see something like that in the Gemara. Or do we say over here, like the Pashtuta Mishnah, the fact that two of the parties require Shvua, anybody wants to collect anything from Yitomim has to take a Shvua that they are entitled to this payment before we allow them to take anything from the estate to repay the debts or the obligations to them, whether it's Duat Yisha or a Baal Chov versus the Yoshim, who are the default stakeholders in the estate? Or is it the fact that a Duat Yisha and a Baal Chov would have to bring proofs that they're owed the money, because the Yoshim don't need to bring any proof because they are the Yoshim and they require no proof to be the owners of the estate? Or possibly lastly, the Yoshim are the Torah inheritors of the estate. Any other claim against the estate is a right that the individual gained through some sort of contractual obligation, whether it was a loan, whether it was a ketubah, but that is not the Torah-prescribed ownership transfer from the parent that passed away to the children that are the Yoshim. So for any of those reasons, or all of those reasons together, Rabbi Akiva believes in this case, the Yoshim are the entitled party here to the estate and not the other individuals. On the other hand, Rabbi Tarfon says that we give it to the Koshel Sheben, to the weakest amongst them. And the Gemara will discuss who is the weakest party over here that will be entitled to it. Heniach Peirot Tlushin Minakarka. He left over fruits that were already detached from the ground. They were already picked and harvested. Kol HaKodem Behem, Zachah Behem. Whoever grabs them first is entitled to them. Zachta Isha. The woman grabbed them, Yoter Miktubata, in excess of the value of Ektubah. Then she keeps whatever is the proper value or payment of Ektubah. Ubal Chov Yoter HaChovo, or the creditor took more than he was owed in debt, and therefore he will keep a portion of it for the repayment of his debt. Hamotar, that excess in either of these cases, Rabbi Tarfon Omer, Yidnatnu LeKoshel Behen. Once again, it should be given to the individual who is in the weakest position over here. Again, here you stemmed the normal process of granting the property to the Yoshim, because someone was tofes, someone grabbed the property early. And once you've done that, now it's not going directly to the Yoshim. So now we have options to distribute it, and we're going to distribute it to the weakest party over here. Bikiv Omer, Ein Merachmim Bedin. What does it have to do with the weakest party? You give it to the party who's most deserving it over here. And once again, Eliyahu Natnu the Yoshin, you give it to the inheritors, Shukulan Tzrichin Shvua. Everybody requires a Shvua to collect from the estate, from the Yitomim. And a Yoshim Tzrichim Shvua. On the other hand, the inheritors do not need a Shvua. They are the default owners of the estate. Salamalei the Mitnei Milve, Velamalei the Mitnei Pikadon. The first case in the Mishnah, it says, well, either if someone has an outstanding loan to another party, or they have a deposit with another party, in each of those instances, this rule applies. What's the difference between whether the person who passed away was a creditor, or he was an owner that deposited something with another party? In both instances, the key element here is it's not in the estate, it's not by the property of the Yitomim, therefore it doesn't automatically go to them. Tzricha, the Gemara says, we need both of them. Ditan milve, if it was only written by milve, Bahakama Rabbi Tarfon. Over there, Rabbi Tarfon agrees that we grab the property and give it to the Koshel Sheben, Mishum de milve lo tzanitna, because that's the nature of a loan. A loan is done in a manner in which the monies are given out, and nobody expects to get the same exact coins back or the same exact bills back. They gave them value, and they expect value in return. But the property in the interim doesn't exist. And then it doesn't exist in the interim. It didn't automatically go to the Yorshim. And that's why these individuals, if the debt is being repaid, can go in there and grab that money on behalf of themselves. About Pikadon, when it comes to a deposit, the Itabene, that is in existence right now. That is something that is tangible and is his, even though it's not in his house. It's somewhere else. It's still his property somewhere else. If that's the case, the Yorshim in the same way will take that property. Not that's here, but it is somewhere else. Maybe over there, Rabbi Tarfon would agree with Rabbi Akiva's position that it goes to the Yoshim. V'tanaha, if the Tana only wrote the case of Pikadon, v'hakama Rabbi Akiva, that's where Rabbi Akiva believes that the Yoshim are the first in line to take it. Aval v'hach, by the case of Milveh, where he agrees that's the Hotzanitna, that the monies are gone and they're almost like a davar shelo b'alei olam now, modulei the Rabbi Tarfon. Rabbi Akiva would agree to Rabbi Tarfon's position that over there we give it a kosher shaban. Tzricha, therefore, mashmalan, that in either of these instances, they each hold their position, that Rabbi Akiva believes in each of these instances, we give it to the Yoshim, and Rabbi Tarfon believes that we give it the Koshel Sheben, Mother Koshel. What does it mean in Rabbi Tarfon's statement in the Mishnah that we give it to the weakest amongst them? Rabbi Chanina Omer, the Koshel Shebraya, the one with the weakest proof in this case. According to Rashi, that's the one with the contract that is dated at the latest time. The person has the latest date, or is the last person to extend credit to this individual, they're in the weakest position, both from the perspective that there are other people who are going to collect before them, before they get paid back, but more importantly, their lien was the last lien. And that means that any transactions that took place prior to their showing up in the picture, they will not be able to collect from. On the other hand, people with earlier dated shtarot can go after property that was sold after they already had a lien. That's the way Rashi explains it. The others explained over here that Koshel B'Sharaya is the Baal Chov. It's always the Baal Ashtar, the Baal Chov, because he's the one who's obligated to prove that there was a transaction. The woman, by definition, by being married to him, is entitled to Ketubah. The Yoshim, by the mere fact that they are his children, are entitled to the estate. The Baal Chov has no natural relationship with this individual, and therefore he's going to have to bring a proof to the fact that he's actually owed the money, or that he's an entitled party over here. And therefore, he's deemed to be the Koshel B'Hem, the weakest party here, because he's the one who needs to bring proof that he's actually a party to this estate. The other reason is that the creditor is in the worst position because he actually gave money up. He extended credit to this individual, as opposed to the Yoshim or the Isha, who are hoping to collect over here, but they never gave the money. They never extended any credit to this individual. These are entitlements that come from their status or standing, not because they actually paid anything or extended any credit to this individual. The Yerushalmi takes it even one step further and says that Koshel B'Raya is the person who has the weakest position over here. Therefore, if you have someone who's a Milveh B'Shtar, Milveh B'Edim, someone who'll lend with a document, someone who'll lend with Edim, the one with Edim is the more difficult position. He's got to bring the Edim in order to make his claim. The person with the Shtar can just show up with the Shtar to make the claim. So the Koshel Sheben here would be the one with the weakest position and the one who has the biggest burden of proof to prove that they are owed money over here. Or the Yerushalmi actually brings an opinion that the Koshel Sheben is a reference to the Ani. The poorest amongst them is entitled to the payment over here when we have a choice of who to distribute it to. And that's maybe makes more sense than what Rabbi Akiva says, Eimer Rachamim B'Din. This is not an issue of mercy. This is an issue of law, and we have to come to the proper conclusion. Just because someone's poor or more needy doesn't mean that over here we're going to grant them better rights within halacha. That's a matter for tzedakah. That's not a matter for the din here. So that's one possibility of what the Koshel Sheben is. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, the Ketubat Isha. The weakest amongst them is the Ketubat Isha. She's the one who always gets the money. Meshum Chinah. Because of the chain, the grace that is associated with the Ketubat Isha. Rashi and Tosafot in many places in Shas argue about what this chinah is. Rashi over here says, Shimzu anashim chen b'ne anashim, that the men will find favor in the eyes of the women, v'yunosot them, and they will marry them, she lo tidagena lafsid ktubatan, because they're not afraid of losing their ktubah. They see that in these circumstances, the ktubat isha will get paid out in these difficult situations, and therefore they'll be more willing to get married and feel secure, because they know in the end that they will get their ktubah. And since that is the case, they'll be more apt to marry the men. The men will find more favor in their eyes for their willingness to marry them because they know that the men will ensure that they get paid out. Because here's another thing that they will benefit from in terms of their ktubah to ensure that they get payment. That Tosafot brings on their Beinu Hananel that the chain is just the opposite. The chain is that the women will find favor in the men's eyes. So Beinu Hananel explains because they will be the beneficiaries of this ktubah. Therefore, if they want to get married again, the monies of the ktubah will be an incentive for someone to marry them. And the chain is the fact that these women are now more appealing to these men. And you can see here in the Gemara that the Aruch explains that the chain is because of the fact that the Yadei Itata, the women know, Demidache Balchov Yershim, that the creditors and the inheritors will be held in abeyance, Lachar Mita, after the death of this individual, Mikama, in the face of her claim over here, Te Misheret at the Bala Bechol Kocha, she will service her husband with all her strength, Michaim, while he's still alive, Mitokach Timsachen Lefanav, she will find favor in his eyes because she'll be more apt to take care of her husband, knowing that this benefit awaits her in the end, or that she'll be well taken care of in the end. V'yeshalom beino leveina. This will create peace between them. So this argument persists many places in Shas, especially in Tubot and Yevamot, as to what chein means. Rashi always thinks that the chein means that the men will find favor in the eyes of the women. And Tosfos believes it's that the women will find favor in the eyes of the husbands. In either case, the meaning here of chena is that Ketubat Isha will be the primary party to get paid out, because they're considered to be Koshel Sheben, the weakest party here, because we're trying to engender something else from the fact that they're getting paid out. And they're getting paid out then helps us to establish that chain that we are looking for. Kitanae, this is similar to Machloket Tanaim. Rabbi Binyamin Omer, the Koshel Shebraya, it's the weakest proof here, as we explained before. V'hu Kasher, and that's the right way to look at it. Rabbi Lazar Omer, the Ketubat Isha Mishum China. Now that goes to the payment of the Ketubat Isha because of the chain that it generates. Eniach Perot Atzlushim. Left behind detached fruits, things that have already been harvested. Rabbi Kiva, my area, Motar. Kulu Nami Dyoshim Havu. Doesn't make so much sense. Rabbi Kiva only argues on the excess. Rabbi Kiva should be arguing on the core position. In that latter part of the Mishnah, Rabbi Tarfon says that the Tfisa, the grabbing of the property by the Isha for Ktuba or the Baal Chov for his Chov is justified. They get to keep whatever is up to the value of their claim, but it's in excess of that claim. Then we have a discussion about what we do with it. Rabbi Tarfon says, goes to Koshel Sheben. Rabbi Kiva says, Eimarach Medina goes to the Yoshim. Why does only the excess go to the Yoshim? According to Rabbi Akiva, who believes that Tfisa does not work at all over here, the Yoshima, the true entitled party over here, then the whole amount should belong to the Yoshim, not just the excess. Gemara says, Enochanami, you're right, that is the case. He was just responding to the claim of Rabbi Tarfon. Since Rabbi Tarfon was talking about the excess, he responded to the excess amount that spoke about. But he himself, he believes not only is the excess amount, but the core amount all belongs to the Yoshim. Now the Gemara says, Rabbi Akiva, Tfisa la Mahanya Klau? Rabbi Akiva really believes that when that person goes in to exert their rights in a position where they might not have been the first in line, that they're allowed to keep that. He doesn't subscribe to that position at all. So Rashi says it's like a general question. How could it be that Rabbi Akiva doesn't hold of this at all? Whereas Tosfot over here says that the Rabbeinu Tam explains this as being in stira to a position Rabbi Akiva that we find in the Mishnah, where Rabbi Akiva seems to indicate that Tfisa does work. So how do we reconcile that? How is it possible that Rabbi Akiva does not believe that Tfisa works over here? So Amarova, Amarav Nachman, Behu Shetafas Michaim. The difference is when the Tfisa was done. If the individual exerts their rights while the party is still alive, then in that case, the Tfisa is effective because their grabbing of the property prevents it from ever reaching the Yorshim. Since it never reaches the Yorshim, that's why the Tfisa is effective. The other hand, a Tfisa that is the Achar Mita, that is after the death, that's not effective because the death itself triggers the Yorshim owning the property. And once they own the property, you can't get in and grab property that belongs to them. Therefore, according to Rashi, that's an answer to a general question, which is Rabbi Akiva does subscribe to Tfisa in a much more qualified manner, only in a case where you take a Michaim. The other hand, Rabbeinu Tam says that this is how you reconcile between Rabbi Akiva's position over here, where Tfisa does not work, because that was done after the death of the party, when the Yoshim already the owners over here. On the other hand, in that Mishnah before, where you thought Rabbi Akiva believed in Tfisa, that was because the Tfisa was done while the debtor was still alive, while the husband was still alive. Although Tosafot points out over here, that Tfisa will only help by a Baal Chov, that Rava agrees that Tfisa Michaim is not a real Tfisa. because the trigger for the indebtedness of the ketubah only happens with the death of the husband. So if the woman goes to take the tfisah prior to his passing, that is not a tfisah because she's not owning anything at that time. The other hand, for the Baal Chov, the creditor who has an outstanding loan to this individual, he is a creditor while the man is still alive. He's a creditor after he dies. So therefore, he does the tfisah beforehand. That's when the tfisah helps. The Rabbi Tarfon, the Manchehecha. According to Rabbi Tarfon, where is this property that these individuals are allowed to be tofeset and that it doesn't automatically go into the possession of the Yorshim? So Rav and Shmuel, the Amrei Tarvayu, Rav and Shmuel both agree, V'hushi tiburim umnuchim berishut harabim. It's a case when they are piled up and left in the Rishut harabim, a place where no one has particular ownership, and a place where kinyanim are generally not effective. And therefore, the Yorshim have no ability to take possession of this property in the Rishut harabim. And that's why in the Rishut harabim, if a person comes in and grabs that property, he will be entitled to it. Aval b'simta, when you're talking about the size of the Rishut harabim, we call it Sidei Rishut harabim, places where Rashi says people, when they want to talk privately or have a transaction, that's where they stand. Those areas are areas where a kinyan mishicha and certain types of kinyanim take effect. And just like over there, the kinyanim are effective because it's not considered to be public property. So too, with regards to the Yorshim's rights, gain ownership over the property, that will happen automatically in the simta, and therefore the tfisa will not be affected over there. V'Rabbi Yochanan v'Reish Lakish, so the Amoraim of Bavel believe that, Rav and Shmuel, whereas the Amoraim of Eretz Yisrael, Rabbi Yochanan v'Reish Lakish, Damrei Tarvayu, Afilu b'Simta. Even in the case of Simta, the Yorshim do not have rights to inherit in that case. Because in the end, this is not the area where it belongs to the Yorshim. It's still a public venue, and you would not automatically assume that that property went into the hands of the Yorshim. Don Dine k'Rabbi Tarfon. The Dayanim paskin like Rabbi Tarfon. V'hadre Reish Lakish l'uvda minayu. And Reish Lakish forced them to reverse their position in this instance, because the halacha is like Rabbi Kiva, not like Rabbi Tarfon. Amar le Rabbi Yochanan asit k'shel Torah. You're making this like a Torah law, where if a judge makes a mistake in an obvious Torah law, we will force him to reverse the case. So you're suggesting over here the fact that the Dayanim paskin like Rabbi Tarfon, that was such a grave error that we would reverse it and reinstate the law like Rabbi Kiva. Lema b'hakam iflegei. Let us say the machloki here between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish had a view, the halachic outcome over here between Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Kiva, as being a machloki premised on this. The Mara Sever Tavrit Var Mishnah Chuzer. Rabbi Shlakish believes if you make a mistake about a Mishnah, you reverse that Psak Halacha. Now, truthfully, even though the Machloket here between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon is a Mishnah, the Halacha principle upon which we are relying is actually a member of a Moraim, that Halacha to Rabbi Akiva Michavero, that whenever Rabbi Akiva argues on a single Tana, the Halacha is like him, but not Michaverav. It's not true when he is arguing on multiple Tanaim. Our mission is a case where he's arguing on a single Tana, Rabbi Tarfon, therefore the Halacha should be the Rabbi Kiva. So as Rashi points out, it's deemed as if this din is like a din in the Mishnah, even though it's not found explicitly in the Mishnah. So Reish Lakish believes, since they made a mistake about a Mishnah, they have to reverse it. On the other hand, Mar Savar Rabbi Yochanan believes, Dvar Mishnah Eino Chozer. When you make a mistake about a Mishnah, then you don't reverse the case, only when it's a mistake about a din that's found in the Torah. So Gemara says, though, the Kuli Alma, Tov, Dvar Mishnah, Chozer. Everybody agrees, if you make a mistake about an explicit Mishnah, we reverse the case. So what's the machlokes here between Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan as to whether Reish Lakish acted appropriately in forcing the Dayanim to reverse their position when they pass on Rabbi Tarfon? Mar Savar Lochin K'Rabbi Akiva, Mechaviro, Velo Mirabo. Rabbi Yochanan believes that the Loch is Rabbi Akiva, like when he's arguing on a peer. But when he's arguing on his Rebbe, that's not the case. The assumption being here that Rabbi Tarfon was his Rebbe. Umar Savar and Reish Lakish believes that Aloha Filu Mirabo, that the Loch is like Rabbi Akiva, even when he's arguing on his Rebbe. And some say they both agree, Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, that the Halacha is like Rabbi Akiva versus his peers, not in his Rebbe. So what's the machloket here? Mar Savar Rabbi Tarfon Rabbo. Rabbi Yochanan believes that Rabbi Tarfon is his Rebbe, and therefore the Halacha is not like Rabbi Akiva in this case. Mar Savar Chaver Chama. And on the other hand, Reish Lakish believes that Rabbi Tarfon was his peer, and therefore the Halacha is like Rabbi Akiva in this instance. Others suggest that everybody agrees that Rabbi Tarfon is a peer of Rabbi Akiva's. And this is the machlok between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. One of them says that when we say that Rabbi Akiva trumps over here, it's halacha. That is the psak halacha that we give. Matin itmar. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan believes matin itmar, which is we give preference to paskin like Rabbi Akiva. But bidiavad, if you pass it like a Rabbi Tarfon, it'll be sufficient. Otherwise, Reish Lakish believes no, that halacha itmar, that is the halacha. And even bidiavad, we would reverse the position if you paskin like Rabbi Tarfon. Maybe the Rabbi Yochanan, the relatives of Rabbi Yochanan in a scenario like this, tvos paradiatme misimta. They grabbed a parad of the Yatomim that was in a simta in a location like this. So these individuals grabbed this parad that was in a simta in order to repay the outstanding obligation this individual had to them, even though the property now belonged to the Yatomim. Atu the kamei the Rabbi Yochanan, they came before Rabbi Yochanan, and Marlehu, he said, Shapir tefastua. You did fine in taking it. You're totally empowered to take this animal in this instance. Now, Tosafot points out that works well according to some of the explanations we gave before in Rabbi Yochanan's position. But in a number of the explanations, when we said that the halacha is like Rabbi Akiva, even Rabbi Yochanan agreed that the halacha was Rabbi Akiva. It was bidiavad. He said that if you paskin like Rabbi Tarfon, it was okay. But not the chatchila. Over here, he seems to be indicating to his relatives that the halacha is like Rabbi Tarfon. Because here they went ahead and grabbed the property and he's telling them it's totally fine. So Tosafot over here asked that question. He says, maybe this is already classified as being a bidiavad case, came into Varkat of Sua, because they already grabbed it. They already took it. If they were asking us before taking it, that would be the din l'chatchila. Once they've taken it already, that already deems it to be a case of bidiavad. And therefore, bidiavad will say the locha is like Rabbi Tarfon. Others still suggest that it's even more of a bidiavad case in a case where they already consumed the para, and therefore we're talking about compensation here, not a returning of the object that they grabbed. Others suggest that Rabbi Yochanan over here was only giving them advice and not necessarily telling them what the psak halacha was in this instance, because Rabbi Yochanan was the nogeva davar, and therefore they couldn't come before him l'din. And that's why the next statement in the Gemara, atu dekameh Rabbi Shimon Lakish. They brought the case before Rabbi Shimon Lakish. If they already brought it to Rabbi Yochanan, why would they bring it to Rabbi Shimon Lakish? Ella, they really couldn't bring it to Rabbi Yochanan. They were just asking him what he thought or what his advice was. And now they bring it for real to Rabbi Shimon Lakish. Amalu, Zilu, Hader, go give it back to them. You're not entitled to this. Atu the kamei to Rabbi Yochanan, they went back to Rabbi Yochanan. Amalu, he says to them, Masa shekinegdi chaluk alai, that my peer argues on me. Meaning that Reish Lakish argues on me, and I'm going to have to defer to his judgment in this case. Ho bakra di yatme. There was this cowboy or herder that took care of the property of the Yatomim. The tafsi toraminei bachov. A creditor of their father came along and grabbed this shore from him. Amar michayim tefisinale. The individual who grabbed it, the creditor who came and took the property, says I took it while the debtor was still alive. Bakra Amar, on the other hand, the shepherd, the cowherder over here says, Lachar mitatav say, you only grabbed it after the death of the debtor. Obviously, that would make a difference as to whether there's entitlement over here. As Rabbi Akiva said before, if you grab it michayim, it works in terms of tvisa. Whereas if you grab it after death, then it should go to the Yoshima. You have no entitlement. So that's exactly what they're arguing about over here. When he grabbed it, was the debtor still alive and therefore he has entitlement to tvisa? Or was the debtor already niftar, and therefore he wouldn't have a right to do the tfisa, and he has to return it. Atu de kamei de Rabbi Nachman, so they brought the case before Rabbi Nachman. Amalei itlach sade de tafse. He says to the cattle herder over here, do you have witnesses that he grabbed it from you? Amalei lav, he says no. Amalei, he says therefore, migo de acholamei mar lakuach ubiadi, since this individual can say now, I purchased it, and that's why it's in my possession. Therefore, he's believed to say that when he took it while the debtor was still alive. Since over here, he actually has a better claim, a claim that it was his all along, and he purchased it from the individual. And the Ro'eh has no proof against that, because yes, it's in his possession now, and he agrees it belonged to the other party. But he bought it from him, and now it's mine. And the Ro'eh cannot undermine that statement, because he has no witnesses that it was ever taken from him by this individual. And therefore, the Migo allows this individual to be believed, and to say that he took it while the debtor was still alive. Other hand, if the shepherd here has witnesses that he took it from him and he never purchased it, then the meagle goes down the drain because he no longer now can make a claim. I took it when it was alive. Now when it's dead, because he no longer has a meagle to say that I purchased it and didn't steal it. Because once we have witnesses that he took it and he didn't buy it, then the meagle goes away and he loses his nemanut. And therefore, all the shepherd needs is witnesses that he took it. Doesn't have to mean that he took it after death, but simply that he took it. And once we know that he took it, he loses his meagle. Once he loses his meagle, he can no longer make the claim to be believed that he took it while the debtor was still alive. And on the other end, the shepherd himself is not sufficient evidence of the fact that this individual took it or to testify about it, because he's a nogea b'davar. The yatomim in the end are going to come and make a claim against him for the money because he lost their shore. He should have protected this shore from being taken by these creditors. And the Gemara asks about this in general. V'amarish lokish hagodrot en lehem chazaka. The fact that an individual has possession of these lighter flock herd animals like the sheep and the goats and the bakar, those you cannot claim that because it's in your possession, it's a chazaka. Because the nature of these animals is to wander around. And therefore, a chazaka cannot be established simply by being in your presence or in your property, because they could have wandered over there. It doesn't mean that you really own them. If that's the case, why do we have a meagle over here? Because the individual who's holding this bakar can't make a claim that he purchased it, and that's why he has it in his possession, because possession is not evidence of anything with regards to these types of animals. So why is there a meagle over here, and why should this individual be believed that he took it while the debtor was still alive? Mar says, Shiny Torah demisira leroeh, that a shor, which is a larger, more expensive animal, is different in this case because he gave it over to a shepherd. So the animal was not wandering around the streets, wasn't wandering anywhere. And therefore now, when this party has it in his possession, if we have no evidence that he stole it or grabbed it from the ro'eh, then he can make a claim that it was purchased from him. In fact, that he can make that claim and doesn't do that, but gives a weaker claim and says, yes, I took it, but I took it while the debtor was still alive, he will be believed because of that migo. The Beinesia Tfos Amto Diatme Misimta. They grabbed a maidservant of Yatomim from a Simta. Yati Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Hanina Bar Papi, Rabbi Yitzchak Nafka. So all these three Amoraim. Yati Rabbi Abba Gabayu. And Rabbi Abba was sitting with them. And as we've noted many times, when they single out one individual, that means he's going to be the linchpin of this Sugya. Amalu Shapir Tifistua. They said, you did it right. You're allowed to take it. Amalahu Rabbi Abba. Rabbi Abba pipes up and says, Meshum de Beinisianinu Machnafitu. Because they are the Beinisian. Therefore, you're being patronizing towards them and you're perverting the din in order to help them out. Vadon Dine Kirabi Tarfon. Don't we have precedents for this before where Dayanim Paskin like Rabbi Tarfon? Vahadre Rish Lakish Umtaminayu. And Rish Lakish reversed that whole din and forced them to give it back. And that should be the same din over here, that the Beinisia would have to give it back, and they were not entitled to take it. We don't paskin like Rabbi Tarfon, even Bidiavad. Yemar Bar Chashu, have a Maisig Bezuze. Bau Gavro, Yemar Bar Chashu was a creditor to a certain individual. Shochiv, he passed away. The Shavik Arba, and he left behind a boat, and the creditor, Yemar Bar Chashu, wanted to go get his money back. So he goes ahead and grabs the boat. But he himself doesn't grab the boat. He sends a agent to grab the boat on his behalf. Amalei Lishluchei says to his agent, Zil Tafso Nialei, go grab the boat on my behalf in payment of the debts that are outstanding over here. Azal Tafso, he went ahead and grabbed it on behalf of this creditor in order to get repayment of his loans. Pagubei Rav Papa of Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua. He bumps into Rav Papa and Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua, who also happen to be creditors of this individual. Amalei Atofes the Bachov B'makum Shechav L'Achirim. Over here, you're grabbing it on behalf of one party to the detriment of other parties. You're grabbing it for Yemer Bachashu, but you're leaving us in a bad position, and you can't do that. Now, this comes out of a principle that we've seen before, which is that when it comes to being zocheh for an individual, you can be zocheh on behalf of one person, but you can't do it at the expense of other individuals. And that's what's happening over here. When you grab it for that one Bachov, you're doing that to our detriment. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan tells us, so to face the Ba'achov b'makom shechav l'achirim, person who goes ahead and grabs property on behalf of a creditor, where it's the detriment of other parties, lokana, there is no kinyan over here. Now Tosfot discusses this and says, why is that true? We know that Rabbi Yochanan believes that an individual can appoint a shliach and say to him, please go pick up that avedah, that last object over there, that's hefker, you go pick it up on my behalf. If the shliach picks it up, and the one who's konen is the person who sent him, and not the agent. It's not for the agent himself. And that's a case where it's shechav l'achirim. When he picks up the object, then nobody else can grab it. And so therefore, when the shliach acts, or the proxy acts on behalf of the person that sent him, he's now benefiting that party at the expense of others. So Tosfot distinguishes between these two cases and says, by the case of avedah, the proxy who is acting on behalf of this party could also act on behalf of himself. If the agent so chooses, he could pick up the object and say, it's mine. It's my mitziah. So since he can pick it up on his own behalf, he can therefore be an agent and pick it up on the behalf of the person that sent him. That's not true here by the case of the creditors. When the creditor sends this individual, this agent, the agent could not take the property for himself because he's not a creditor. And since he cannot act on behalf of himself, he can also not act on behalf of the creditor to the detriment of other creditors. And that's why over here, his agency fails, whereas by the case of Mitziah, his agency is fulfilled according to Rabbi Yochanan. And as Tosfot points out over here, this is even if he makes him into a real agent. It's not simply that he did it on his behalf and he was zocheh without any shlichut, as Rashi explains about Mitziah, but rather, here's a case where he appointed him as a shliach, as an agent, and it still fails. There are other cases discussed by the Rishonim where there might be an ability to empower the individual so much that he becomes the yad of the Baal, the yad of his sender. He becomes an extension of the sender and not just an agent. In that case, maybe it would work here, but with the regular type of shlichut, it would not be sufficient to allow this individual to do something on behalf of his sender to the detriment of other parties. So Tafsua Inu, Rav Papa and Rav Huna Bered Rav Yeshua grabbed it from themselves then. Rav Papa Mimlach Meluche. Rav Papa steered the boat by its rudder. Rav Huna Bered Rav Yeshua Mimtachla Ba'ashlo. He actually drove the boat by using its ropes. Now, you couldn't say that the Ashla, that is, he moved the masts around on the boat, or you could talk about a boat that's on a canal or an inland river, where they used to pull the boats upriver using ropes. And so he grabbed onto those ropes that pulled the boat upriver. Marama ana kinyanala lekula. One of them said, I took possession of all of it. Marama ana kinyanala lekula. And the other one said, I took possession of all of it. Each one was arguing who had a better kinyan on the boat over here, and therefore should be the owner, quote-unquote, of the boat, or be able to fulfill his outstanding debts to this individual by taking the boat. So Pagubo Rav Pinchas Barami. So Rav Pinchas Barami, while they were arguing about this, bumped into them. Amalu, Rav Ushmod Amrei Tarvayu, V'hu Shetzvoyim Munachim Bershut Rabim. The Tfis of Abachol is only successful if you do that when the property is lying in Rishut Rabim. Whereas here, you're talking about a boat on the edge of the river, is the equivalent of a simta. If that's the case, you were not successful at the Tfisa because you took it in a place where the Yorshim already gained control over it, according to Rav and Shmuel. Amalu, Ana, Nami, Micharifuta, Denara, Tfisna. I didn't grab the boat, or we didn't try to take possession of this boat while it was on the edge of the canal. It was when it was in the middle of the river, or the middle of the canal, and therefore it was the equivalent of a Rishut Rabim, and when we exercised some sort of kinyan on it, it should be successful as being a tfisa, even according to Rav and Shmuel. Atu de kamei de Rava. They brought their case before Rava. Amar lehu, he said to them, kake chivare, you white geese, which was a term of endearment, saying you chachamim. And as the Gilyan Ashas points out here, that in the last parak in Brachot, it says over there, someone who dreams about a white goose is an auspicious sign, and therefore one should look forward to being a Talmud Chacham, or look forward to wisdom. So we see that association of avazim with chokhmah. Mishalche lime d'inche, mishalche lime d'inche, those that strip off cloaks from other parties, like over here where they're grabbing someone else's property. Hachi amar Rav Nachman. This is what Rav Nachman says. Bo shetafsa michayim. The loch is like Rabbi Akiva, and tfisa does not help after the death of the individual like you guys did. Tfisa is only successful or helpful if it's done while the debtor is still alive. And therefore, your tfisa over here is meaningless, so you don't even have to argue between yourselves about who has a better kinyan. Neither of you have a kinyan over here because it belongs to the Yorshim and your tfisa was unsuccessful. Okay, we're going to stop here 10 lines down on the top of Pehei Amud Aleph.